Yeah.
I'm not. I have a plan.
Brave Sophie. This be the story of a little gal. It'll be great adventures and laughter. Times will be hard, times will be soft. So hold your breaths, cross your fingers, here we go.
I'm going to call you BFG.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja, here with Nathan. And his sister Rachel is joining us once again for our last and final and fourth and however else we're going to conclude this thing on Spielberg, all things Spielberg. Well, not all things Spielberg.
All fantastical things Spielberg.
So we're looking forward to concluding that. We are going to actually conclude the podcast talking about the BFG. All three of us saw it. So really excited to get to that one. But first, before we go into that, Nathan, we're going to pick up with Minority Report. So why don't you go ahead and just dive away and start us off.
Okay. So just to backtrack ever so slightly, we finished up talking about AI, artificial intelligence, last week.
Yep.
And we actually had quite a bit to say on it. It was Spielberg's like big science fiction movie picked up after Stanley Kubrick was working on it. It wasn't a huge, huge hit. I mean, I think it did well financially. At that point in time, like all Spielberg movies tend to do decently. But I think in a lot of perspective, people saw it as sort of a disappointment. But Spielberg at that point was already moving on and picking up with his next science fiction movie because it came out literally the next summer in just about the same time frame, which I think was like that June 28th time frame. And this was a Minority Report based off a short story by Philip K. Dick. And for any of you guys who probably know, Philip K. Dick tended to write very strange, very odd stories, science fiction stories that were a little tad metaphysical, a tad eccentric, sometimes really, really out there, sometimes a little drug-induced. And then studios are known for taking his work and turning it into much more palatable, usually good, movies that bear a vague resemblance to the story he actually wrote. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was turned into Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. We'll Remember It For You Wholesale was turned into Total Recall twice. Yep. The Adjustment Bureau was turned into The Adjustment Bureau.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tend to take stories and turn them into something that's palatable, but with a central core idea that usually can be traced back to some way to Philip K. Dick. Minority Report's the same way. It's based off a short story that has very, very little resemblance to the story that Spielberg actually makes. The movie that comes out stars Tom Cruise. This is the first time Tom Cruise, to my knowledge, works with Spielberg. Mm-hmm. And he had already kind of come into his Tom Cruise runs phase, which he has not yet left, where every movie is essentially Tom Cruise runs. I think even Jerry Maguire was Tom Cruise runs at some point. But the story takes place in a future District of Columbia in Washington, D.C.,
yeah,
where crime has essentially been eradicated, most major crime, because they have these three individuals who are known as precogs, who they have inside of a tank. This pre-crime unit is operating in such a way that the precogs send signals or visions into the machine that then produces a name of a victim and a name of the assailant, the person that will commit the crime. And these are usually crimes, we're talking about murder in most cases, but various crimes where there is a victim and an assailant. And these are always happening before the crime has happened, but not necessarily that much before. So the pre-crime units rush in. They still have to sort of play detective work to figure out where this crime is going to take place. But most of the time, they get there in enough time to secure the person because they actually haven't committed the crime yet. Mm-hmm. The big idea at the heart of the movie, of course, is how sure a thing is pre-crime. How can we really trust it? We're essentially arresting people who have committed no crime. And the questions that come out in the movie, this is one of the first movies you see Colin Farrell in.
Yep.
I think he'd done a few before this.
American Outlaws was shortly before this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anyone saw American Outlaws. I do remember it, though. He was also in Hearts War, another movie I don't think many people saw. Those were all directly before Minority Report. In Minority Report, he is the CIA or FBI. He's come in to investigate pre-crime.
Yeah.
He's a young kind of headstrong Irish guy. Basically, he's Colin Farrell. Right, with a badge. And he comes in and he is chasing – he ends up chasing – John Anderton, who is a Tom Cruise character.
Yeah.
But before that, he's investigating pre-crime because his supposition is, how do we know that this system is locked tight? Because, again, we have tons of people who are in cryo arrest. Essentially, when they arrest them, they put them in this sort of cryo prison where they're all frozen. And how do we know without a doubt that this was their future? And what Tom Cruise says, his character, Anderton, is espousing is, well, the precogs don't see what you intend to do. They see only what you will do. That's the idea. That these individuals had no other future. You know, he does the scene where he rolls the ball and Farrell catches it and he goes, well, why did you do that? He goes, well, I caught it because it was going to fall. Well, yeah, it was going to fall. Just because you caught it doesn't mean it wasn't going to, you know, but you stopped it. So there's this idea at work of predestination, or how much do we have in control of our destinies, and can things be changed? So do any of these people have a possible future? The title Minority Report comes from the fact that Tom Cruise discovers that every once in a while, one of the three precogs, specifically Agatha, who is the female precog, there's two, they all have names after famous mystery writers, is Agatha Dashiell and... I should be able to remember the third one, but it's not coming to me right now. And basically what happens is he ends up on the run because a murder pops up with his name, and again, there's a victim's name. And instead of hanging around, he bolts and then chase him. Maximus Seydal plays the head of pre-crime. He's the guy who's actually at the forefront of like inventing it and bringing the precogs in and using them. So the whole movie is really kind of a cat and mouse movie. It's much more of an action movie than the previous an AI was, but it still has that kind of idea of a person on the run, of sort of a quest where someone is searching for something, and it's all happening in a small period of time. That's the basic setup. There's a lot more going on with the movie. It's funny, a few weeks ago, Rachel, you and I sat down and started to watch it. Think just because it was so late, we didn't get a chance to finish it. And watching the first half of the movie, I remembered that, yeah, it's a really enjoyable science fiction adventure movie. It feels like Spielberg's kind of try his hand at like the Ridley Scott style of filmmaking, because at that point, Ridley Scott was kind of back in his full swing at that point. He'd done Gladiator. He had done Black Hawk Down. I think he was just coming off of those movies. So Ridley Scott was a force to be reckoned with again. And so I felt like some of Spielberg is trying a few different things. There's a lot of the shaky cam kind of stuff. There's a washed out sort of bluish look to the movie. There's a lot of neat futuristic stuff going on. But the first half is pretty much a standard fugitive style action movie, I feel like. So let's talk about that first, because I think the movie changes a lot in the second half. And there's a good point to bring in that discussion. We talk about like Spielberg going through these kind of phases where he takes a different look at belief and he takes a different look at things like faith and wonder and whatnot. And I think Minority Report on the surface is a more of a gritty, grungy sci-fi movie, not that he normally does. So I think it'd be interesting to look at where does the Spielberg element weigh in on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like you said, there is a grittier element to it. We see that Tom Cruise's character, Anderton, isn't a clean-cut officer in and of himself. You know, he's had this horrible thing happen to him. His family's in disarray, and you know, he's a drug user essentially. You know, and that's how he kind of gets through his evenings alone. And so we see that grittier real life element coming out even from the very onset of it, before he's even, you know, being chased down because of the precogs.
I'd like a lot of Spielberg movies would always make me think just a little bit, I think, outside the box. And with this one of the things that always got me is one of the first crimes that you see them interrupt is not like, you know, in Unbreakable, some of the crimes that he was going, I think it was Unbreakable, Bruce Willis, where he was going and interrupting some of these murders. They're like premeditated and criminal. Not that, you know, just like, I don't know how to explain it, but like malicious, premeditated stuff. Mm-hmm. The thing that they interrupt in Minority Report in the first one is a crime of passion. So probably not something this man would plan to do, or maybe not even be his like natural character. It's just he's in this very heated moment. And so the first time I watched the movie, I was like, how come they didn't just interrupt the murder, or maybe send this man to counseling? Why wasn't the objective just to save the lives? But it's actually they're going to prosecute him and send him to jail, basically. And so for me, that early on, even before everything else starts rolling in the film, those questions were already coming to my mind, which is, how fair is this? How right is this? Is this really the way that things should be? And for me, that was sort of typical of how Spielberg kind of calls me in to interact with his films.
Yeah, I think that's like that first scene in Minority Report is a really strong, like, mm-hmm. we talked about the visceral Spielberg scenes. Mm-hmm. That opening scene is really visceral. There's a lot of visceral scenes in the movie, but mm-hmm. you jump right into it. It's really tense right off the bat. They do an excellent job of getting you into this fantasy, slightly futuristic world. And I thought they developed the idea of the pre-crime and how they were getting the information and how they were solving the crimes, even though it's a very futuristic and maybe not even that realistic like setting. They were able to establish that. They established the fact that the first scenes we're watching are not actually happening yet. They're the pre-vision. Mm-hmm. And then we watch them racing to stop the vision. That was a lot of intricate editing and a lot of intricate filmmaking that goes into that opening scene. And it's very fluid. Like, you learn a lot about that world and how it operates off of, and the theoretical and philosophical and even theological to some extent concepts that are going on are all mm-hmm. laid out very neatly and very fluidly in that very first scene. Mm-hmm. And the actor, Eric Gross, who probably no one really recognizes, but I recognize him from a bad horror movie from the 80s called House 2, the second story.
Yes.
So, but his small scene where he plays the husband who is, like you say, caught in the crime of passion, and they mention that uh-huh. crimes of passion are often the hardest because they come in the latest, because they aren't premeditated, mm-hmm. and that they're the ones that are hardest to like make sure that they prevent. So you see that scene happening. Like you mentioned, Anderton is not – he's probably the like one of the darker Spielberg heroes, at least mm-hmm. in the fantasy films, because he is – in a lot of ways, he's emotionally bottomed out. He's the head of pre-crime. Pre-crime's doing well, but he's only in pre-crime because of the fact that his son was abducted at a local pool when he was watching him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
His marriage has fallen apart, and his one drive to – he's saying that his drive is to do this so it doesn't happen to anyone else, but he's so dead set on it, he's not paying attention to other things. He's not paying attention to the possible not innocence of the people that he's arresting. He's also not paying attention to some of the manipulation that's going on around him as the mystery story unspools. The other thing, and this is the part I think surprises, that I've always find is the hardest thing to swallow about the Minority Report setting. You think it would be the pre-crime with them arresting them. I have a harder time wondering how they got the precogs in the tank. You have three people that they basically have like stranded dolphins. I mean, they're pretty much in a continually drugged state where they're only being used as conduits. And they talk about how these were young kids having terrible, horrible dreams. And somehow this society has made a jump to put these three together for the greater good of the city.
I was going to say the sacrifice for the greater good.
Yeah, it's like the Ursula K. Le Guin short story, the Ones Who Walk Away from the Omalas, which is like a very classic dystopia story where they live in a perfect seeming utopia, but one day they take everybody who lives in the society and tell them to go down in the basement where there's one child who's constantly being tortured and harmed and hurt. But that is the tipping scale that the society sustains on. They basically say this is why everything is so good. One person has to constantly suffer so everything else can be good. Mm. So Spielberg kind of sets that up in a way.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of, like, it's very on the nose, I think the script is in some cases. There's a lot of dialogue where when Farrell comes in, he's talking about how the building they're in is kind of like a church. And they call it, what do they say? They call it like the temple or something.
It's the temple, yeah.
Yeah, and he talks about the precogs, and he talks about how, well, aren't we kind of like priests and sin, dealing with sins and things like that? And you mentioned Unbreakable. In Unbreakable, the interesting thing, like that scene where Bruce Willis's character, David Dunn, puts his hands out and is touching people as they brush by him, and he's seeing the sins they've actually committed. The difference is Unbreakable, he's seeing what people have actually done. Minority Report takes that same kind of conceit, but it's the idea of these are the things you have yet to do, and will you do them?
Yeah.
So I thought the first half of the movie is kind of like just you're getting into the future world. You have a lot of weird things. Peter Stormare shows up again as a crazy guy who helps him take his eyes out.
Yeah.
You have the spiders
Yeah.
Remember the spiders, yep. The creepy little sensors who sprout legs?
Yeah.
And there's a really neat, a lot of great filmmaking. There's a scene eventually when he gets Agatha out of the tank and they go to solve the mystery. I won't go into too much detail about that, but there's one scene where they're trying to run away from the police who are pursuing them, and Agatha is quickly using her flashes of precognition to tell them, well, there's going to be a... You know, there's going to be like a mop there. Someone will trip over here.
Right.
There's going to be something
yeah.
here. Run here. Do this. And he is instantly reacting to what she's telling him, and everything is stuff that is just about to happen. Again, really neat filmmaking where it feels like a
yeah.
Rube Goldberg contraption mixed with, like, I don't know, any story where you have somebody with the ESP or precognitive
right.
abilities. Samantha Morton is the character who is Agatha. When she's out of the tank, that's a really weird, strange performance because she seems... She's constantly being faced with what is about to happen and the real world, like, almost simultaneously.
Right.
So she's just living in a limbo somewhere in between.
Yeah. Yeah. No, great stuff. You know, I remember when Minority Report came out, seeing it, really enjoying it for the first time, thought it was unique and different. And then in subsequent watches, though, I felt like there was something in there that was just kind of missing. And I don't know... necessarily what it is. Can't really put my finger on it as, you know, like I said, I saw it was great. This was fun, exciting. And then, you know, second time, it's like, okay, this is a pretty good movie. But then going back and watching it, you know, four or five times later, it's like something was lost in it. It didn't seem like one of those movies that I could just keep putting in and going back to. And I don't know if part of that was, you know, when you have those movies with like the ESP and things like that, you're almost at the edge of your seat with the character at that point going through that adventure with them. And then you're almost the person with the ESP after that where, oh, yeah, that's where they're going. That's what they're doing. Your thoughts on that, Nathan, then Rachel?
And, you know, I'd agree with you. When I watched it the other night, I kind of felt like exactly what you're saying. I got about just to the midpoint, just where he takes Agatha from the tank. And I guess, Rachel, you really didn't get any further than that.
I mean, I watched it back closer when it first came out, and I just hadn't seen it, so I don't have, like, as you were talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember some of these scenes, but with the exception of the first half, I'm not
so super. What did you think about the first half, though, in terms of, like, kind of what Nathan is saying? And
I don't know, it's hard for me to take stuff out of context a little bit.
I think that in Minority Report, when you get to the second half of the movie, like after Agatha's out of the tank, and you start to realize where he's going, what his ultimate destination that the machine has foretold and the precogs have foretold, and he is wondering if he has a Minority Report, if he has an alternate future. Is it possible? He's like, I don't even know the person I'm supposed to kill this afternoon. There must be a Minority Report out there. And he's already seen a flash of something, which is what got him into trouble in the first place. Mm-hmm. When he gets there, and I think when he walks in the room and what he sees is this guy in a room with hundreds and hundreds of pictures and stuff that shows that identify, I believe, his son. And he realizes that he's just found.
Yeah.
He turns to Agatha and says, there is no Minority Report. This is my future. I'm going to kill this man. When he realizes who it is he's after. So the movie builds up to that, and it's a really powerful scene because he is presented with this. The guy tells him, oh, well, I took him to get a hot dog. I did all this stuff with him, and he was a pretzel. He was happy. He was happy. And what did you do? He goes, I sunk him in the river. And he starts telling those details, and you imagine this guy sitting there listening to this guy explain to him how he killed his son. And Agatha's screaming in the background, and she's basically saying, well, you have a choice. This is not predestined. So he basically breaks the concept of pre-crime because he decides, which I thought was a powerful scene where there's a hinging on something more powerful in there, is he decides not to kill this guy.
Yeah.
Now, as it turns out, the precogs weren't wrong because the guy still ends up going out the window because of this whole the revelation that John Anderton was really set up from the beginning.
Yes.
But it almost doesn't matter that this is not the guy who killed his son because he's put it to peace.
Right.
He's made the decision. He's been put into the scenario where he could kill him, but he doesn't. And now having a kid, like watching those scenes, they flash back to when he loses the boy at the pool. Those scenes were more affecting to me. And the second half of the movie really starts to get into these questions of what does free will look like? And is free will, you know, we think about it as a blessing, we think of it as a curse. What – what are the real elements of free will, and why should we be glad that we do ultimately have free will, that really, you know, and how do those things go hand in hand with the concepts like predestination? You know, from a theological perspective, people can always debate that, you know.
Right.
What's the perspective that shows me that everything's predestined, and do I really have a place, but I'm not a robot, I'm not an automaton? I think those ideas come out pretty well in the second half of the movie. The best scene, I think, in the movie is when Agatha is at the house that John and his wife lived at, and she is picking up all the memories of the boy, and she seems to be having splintered visions. She's talking about, and you don't know if she's just picking up their emotions. She's talking about him going off to college and getting married and all of these happy memories they wanted to have, and then she's flashing in and saying, he wants to reach his father. The other man is just too fast. And she's having split visions of what happened to him, but what they wanted,
the life they wanted to have.
It's like kind of heartbreaking. And when where the story goes, and how it's ultimately Sydow's character who breaks and proves that the Minority Report doesn't work, I feel like Spielberg gets into some really kind of interesting emotional stuff in the second half of the movie. But you're right. I think in a sense Minority Report kind of just feels a little hollow until the second half. It's an exceptionally well-made movie.
Yeah.
And I think I enjoyed it maybe a little more than AI if you compare the first two viewings. Mm-hmm. But AI has grown, in my opinion, and Minority Report still you're right. There's something that doesn't allow it to get over the line into great.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could pinpoint what it is, but I think I wish the movie had taken more chances like it does in that second half. There's also I always thought the movie was over, just like with AI, when they put Anderton in him in the cryo tube, and he's basically, you know, he's in there dreaming of his son, and you think, well, that's a sad ending, but, you know, how could it have been otherwise?
Right.
And then Spielberg keeps moving, gives us the happy ending. The original ending mentions that the precogs are released from the tanks. They go on to live their lives. And then in the original cut, the next title card says there were so many thousand murders in the District of Columbia that year. Geez. Spielberg actually removed that because he thought it was so downbeat. But to me, you need that. That's the emotional crux of what we're saying. It's like, you've chosen to take the child out of the basement, you know, like the Umalas, but as a result, you now have entered crime back in the world. What sacrifice is willing to, you know, annihilate this danger and this destruction?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good thoughts. Almost immediately after this movie, we see Spielberg and Cruise teaming up again in War of the Worlds. Now, I will say, I haven't seen this movie. I was initially excited for it because I did, like I said, the first time Minority Report came out, I was excited for it. I thought it was a good movie. Dakota Fanning was playing the little girl. She had, you know, been growing and making a name for herself at this point. So I thought, you know, it was going to be really good. And then I remember it just being absolutely panned. And because I didn't see it, I'm going to kind of hang back a little more. But Rachel, Nathan, your thoughts on this movie and, you know, what he did or didn't do right or well, go.
I actually was not a fan of it. I found Tom Cruise to be like a little bit obnoxious, and I don't know if it's the way the movie was filmed or everything was just everything kind of happening fast at moments, very like up close in your face scenes. And you know, Cruise's character is supposed to be kind of jerkish, but, like, he takes it to a good level on that one. And then Dakota Fanning's, like, screaming in the camera, and there's just a lot of chaos and stuff going on. And for me, a lot of things that felt disjointed. And then you have, I don't know, especially with the aliens, and they were coming down, you realize they're harvesting people. And I was just, like, I felt like it was choppy, a little disjointed, and just a lot of stuff thrown at you really fast and happening really quickly, rather than per se a story playing out with like fluidity. And I guess for me, like, less storytelling, more just a lot of stuff in the camera. That's the way it felt.
And if you remember last time in this whole process we've been talking about these movies, I think the last time we described one of his movies like this was The Lost World, Jurassic Park, The Lost World. I think this movie has a lot in common with that movie. I agree with Rachel. I really didn't care for it. It's one thing's interesting, and it never. I don't think it really happened until when Spielberg did Jurassic Park, the original Jurassic Park. That was, I believe, the first year. I could be wrong, but I believe it's the first year where he actually started where he directed two movies in the same year, and they were huge movies, Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. They both get released in the same year, and they're both huge movies in their own right. And he does this a few more times throughout his career. One of the times he does it in 2002 with Minority Report. He releases Minority Report and Catch Me If You Can in the same year.
Yes.
Catch Me If You Can, not a fantastical movie, but I think a really good movie.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it might have had that heart that was a little bit missing from Minority Report. You could go to that one and follow up the father and son themes. Well, obviously, Minority Report are very heavy in Catch Me If You Can. Yes. Christopher Walken was great as the dad in that. A couple years later, he does The Terminal, which is his attempt again in a comedy, and it got to me, kind of fumbled, didn't quite know what he wanted to do with it. And then he comes in and he does War of the Worlds again, or he works with Tom Cruise again, I should say. The thing about War of the Worlds, so when Minority Report was made, it releases in the summer of 2002. We talked last time about how AI is one of those last few movies that had the shots of the trade towers in it.
Yes.
So AI was a pre-Trade Towers Falling movie. But in a lot of ways, so was Minority Report, I believe. Because even though it wasn't complete when the trade towers fell, it was already in production. Mm-hmm. It had already gone through. So both of those movies I would consider to be Spielberg pre-9/11. Not that you see this huge change in Spielberg in terms of the movies he makes. But I think War of the Worlds... Compare the movie, which again, it is based off of the H.G. Wells classic story. Mm-hmm. It has the tripods. The tripods don't make as much sense, I think, in a modern setting, because in the old original War of the Worlds, they're almost fighting them in a Victorian setting, you know? Yeah. And so that battle is very different, and it's a lot more tense. The tripods walking around all gonky-like with our modern weaponry, it doesn't sound like they would last long at all, shields or no, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can imagine a couple guys like piling on a tower so they trip. But the other movie that was made in 1960s, War of the Worlds, got around that bit, just making them spaceships with giant lantern beams on the top, the George Powell movie, which scared the crud out of me as a child. They had the beams that come down and would just turn people, melt them into pieces. So Spielberg does this. You can definitely see the difference between a movie like this, Spielberg's earlier alien movies, and even in a disaster alien movie like Independence Day, which is pre 9/11. War of the Worlds is very much a post 9/11 because it's like a terrorist attack. It happens suddenly. We see the dust clouds that kind of come down and settle. Mm-hmm. All that imagery we associate with 9/11, there's a lot of it in the movie. There's Spielberg, when he gets to the harvesting scenes and the aliens grabbing everyone up, he does go back to those like Warsaw ghettos, those Holocaust kind of imagery, when you see all the tattered ashes coming from the sky and you realize it's bits of clothes and bits of people that have been incinerated. It also feels hollow in the center. Tom Cruise's character, he is kind of a jerk. He's this you've got the single dad. And again, we have this element where the supernatural force comes in and tries to unite – doesn't try to unite the family, but the family is united by trying to struggle against this force. This force, of course, being the aliens. You're right about it being choppy because Spielberg can't decide if he wants to show us the whole world in peril or he just wants to focus in on this one family. And he tries to do both, and I don't think it's really effective. Mm-hmm. Dakota Fanning screaming really bothered me for whatever reason in a very off-putting way. And it wasn't just like – the creation of suspense, it just created a weird nerve-jangling experience that, to me, it didn't work because it felt like they ran here are the tripods. And the tripod became like the T-Rex. It would jump up from under the water. It would grab the ferry. You had all these really nice set pieces, not tied to anything. And Spielberg kept looking for a theme. You know, in the original story, they're ultimately defeated, and they're defeated here, too, by a virus. Of course, Independence Day tried to make a little joke out of that and have the Mac virus defeat them. But, you know, ultimately the microbes killed them. And in the PAL version, they're in the church praying, and then the ships crash into the church, and we realize that the microbes, of course, Wells' line about, you know, that the smallest of organisms of God and his infinite wisdom, you know, blah, 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 and the aliens are now dead, and they've all been defeated, not by any real work of man, but just because we're dirty little... dirty little beings that got them sick.
Dirty little freaks.
Yes, pretty much. And it's interesting because the Spielberg movie not only decides not to end it in the church, it breaks the church apart in almost the first action scene. So Spielberg starts removing all of the like vestiges of sanctuary that there are. They run up to the church. It splits in half, and the tripod crawls up out of the ground. Mm-hmm. You see trains on fire, and there's jets falling from the sky. There's a lot of suggestion of things. There's a scene where his son runs over the hill to join in this fight, and you just see the clouds and the kind of warfare going on. Very modern ideas of warfare. It's not a fun movie. It's not a popcorn movie. But it's also not really that serious. It's kind of a weird goofy downer of a science fiction movie, okay. and characters that should be annihilated show up later just because Spielberg decides that they should be. So I wasn't really taken with it, and I couldn't quite figure out what exactly he was trying to say. To me, it wasn't very satisfying as an action-adventure movie. Mm-hmm. It had individual scenes. It was like Lost World. It kind of felt like he wanted to go back to that well, but mm-hmm. his heart just wasn't in it. Because I don't think his heart is into that darker stuff.
I think calling it hollow is exactly right. That's sort of how I felt about it. Because when I watched it, I think the first time I watched it, my reaction to it was, oh, they're trying to do a nostalgic reach back. Oh, we're going to revisit War of the Worlds, and we're going to keep the tripod thing so that that imagery that people want to see again. And yeah, to me, I thought he was trying to bring back a concept, bring back a nostalgic piece, but did so kind of haphazardly, kind of chaotically a little bit, and without really having a heart or a story really like tie it up. It was more just imagery. Just here's this scene and here's this scene, and you react to it, and this is how we feel about this. And I don't know. It didn't work for me.
And that goes back, that's why I wanted to bring it back to that idea of him releasing the two movies. He also, the two times I mentioned, I think were the more successful ones, where Catch Me If You Can, Minority Report, and Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Yeah.
But he also did it in 1997 when he did The Lost World and Amistad the same year.
Yes.
And I feel like in both of those cases, neither movie was quite as strong as it could be. Amistad felt like, well, Lost World clearly falling Jurassic Park's shoes. Amistad following in Schindler's List shoes, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And neither one was as strong as it could be. I like Amistad as a movie. I don't really care for Lost World. In 2005, he does the same thing because he does War of the Worlds and he does Munich at the same time, which is the more drama movie. And again, terrorist plot involved.
Yeah.
So you see him kind of working through, I think, that post 9/11 anxiety. And yet, to me, in both of those movies, they felt a little fumbled. I couldn't quite connect with either one of those movies. Mm. I think Munich is a better movie than The War of the Worlds. But War of the Worlds, to me, it just lacked something that is essential to Spielberg, is that he didn't really have any capture on the hope that people feel.
Yeah.
Or the hope that people can feel even in dark circumstances. That was present in Minority Report.
I didn't connect to it at all.
No, me neither.
Anyway.
Well, then we come to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
And then we immediately go away.
And then we immediately go away, because that's pretty much all that movie did. real quick, about this movie. I can remember when I first saw the trailer for it, it was a teaser trailer. You know, you had the music playing, the hat blowing across, and Harrison Ford picking it up and putting it on. And that's really all you got. And I remember being so excited about this because this was, you know, everyone was anticipating this. I was anticipating this. He ends with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade with Sean Connery. That was a really good movie. Really enjoyed it. Just fun adventure. Thought they were going to go back to it. And then they bring in Shia LaBeouf and Kate Blanchett. And just, I don't know. It fell apart so badly.
Quickly.
And I don't know, maybe you guys can, you know, just chime in on this a little bit, but I almost feel like when they deviated and went to the crystal skulls, this alien weird technology thing, I almost feel like if they had kept it like a legitimate adventure where they were trying to dig up some legitimate artifact instead of science fiction, it might have been different. Thoughts on that, Rachel?
Yeah, I think I would agree. As you were talking, I was trying to like really pinpoint it, because it wasn't a movie that really made me go back and think on it very much. I was just like, oh man.
It came and went away.
Yeah, it did. I remember that they were trying to capture some of the original stuff you got in the first Indiana movies, which is the action scenes and hanging off of trains and stuff like that. And so that was that they were trying to bring some of that back, and that was drawing me in a little bit. But the story was just, I don't exactly know how to describe it, but when it was started getting into the crystal skulls and this alien thing, it lost a certain vibe for me. It lost a certain feeling for me, and it just felt past ridiculous. I don't know.
Yeah. Nathan?
You know, this is where I do end up in a minority, because I think by far this is the best of the Indiana Jones movies. By far. Surprise!
And we will have a replacement next week.
Nathan did the drink reviews by himself prior to the...
You know, this came after the prequels. We really should have known, but I think everybody was counting on Spielberg to balance Lucas out. And that's what everyone kept saying. Lucas and Ford got – I mean, Spielberg and Ford got this. They're going to keep him in check. And even Shia LaBeouf at that point, he had been in some movies like Holes and stuff like that, and even the first Transformers. At that point, he hadn't really lost his mind the way he has now. And I don't think he really hadn't like irritated people beyond the point of no return. So I feel like – even he wasn't a big like deal breaker. I think everybody was waiting to see how he would be. They wanted to find out if he was going to be Indiana Jones' son. Bringing Karen Allen back as Marion was a nice touch because she really hadn't been in anything in a very long time.
Right.
And it was nice to see her. I think you're right. It's interesting because as soon as they get away from the archaeological storyline and they go the alien route, it falls apart. But I don't know if it's just because of that, because it really gets silly from the beginning. I mean – there's a website now called Nuke the Fridge, which came about because of that awful scene where the fridge is blown up and Indy is inside of it and it crashes down. And, of course, we want to get that scene where he stands on the precipice and now you've got Indiana Jones, this kind of 30s pop icon, you know, not really from the 30s, but that's the time frame. All the imagery with him is the Nazis. And now here he is juxtaposed against a mushroom cloud, which is a cool image, but the way they get there is horrible. And the little CGI groundhogs in the beginning, these are all the things you'll hear your typical critics complain about.
Yeah.
It's but in the beginning, if you take some of those things away, I was still kind of enjoying it. Like, oh, there's Ford again. They have to run through the... they're in the basically same warehouse where the Ark is.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought that was fun. I mean, again,
and
there's Lucas.
That's where I was when it first started out. I was like, this is reminiscent of the old Indiana Jones. It got me interested.
I was intrigued by Cate Blanchett playing the villain and the idea that they're going to bring in the communists. But they really, like, hamstring her character. She wants to be a psychic. And the weird thing is that she ultimately meets her demise and everything she's after. She's not after world domination. She wants knowledge. So there's this weird kind of idea that any woman seeking knowledge should be destroyed by alien forces. I mean,
there's the 1950s for you.
That was crazy to me. Yeah, but the movie wasn't made in the 1950s. Yeah, yeah. It was made in 2008.
Yeah.
And those elements, the first scene when they're on the campus and Indiana Jones comes back, he loses his job, Jim Broadbent is there talking to him. He says, we're at the age now where life takes away more things than it gives. And like, I was into all that. Even the scene where the greasers and the preps come out and have a big fight and that chase across the campus, I was enjoying that. That kind of brought me back to Crusade. And then it falls apart, and I don't think it's just at the aliens. It doesn't matter that the Crystal Skull looks like a giant piece of, like, plastic, like, you know, pyroform with, like, looks like somebody crunched up a bunch of, like, packing peanuts and jammed it inside of it. It's the shoddiest looking alien head I've ever seen. And it's not even just that, but in the story, he goes into the jungle because John Hurt, crazy old John Hurt, has wandered through the jungle, gone into the temple, found the Crystal Skull, and wandered back out. All Indiana Jones does, he struggles for 2 hours to follow what a crazy out-of-his-mind old man just wandered off and did.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones, who's the big explorer, the big adventurer, who's always on the cusp of finding things, he just follows in the footsteps of a crazy old man, and it takes him longer, and he almost gets killed doing it. The action scenes don't have any sense of gravity because they don't look like they're there anymore.
Yeah. You got Mutt Williams, Shia LaBeouf's characters, you know, straddling two Jeeps doing this weird fencing sword fight.
Right
thing.
Before he was picked up by the monkeys.
Yes.
Who look at his little ducktail curl in the front, and because the monkeys have similar ducktail curls, they initiate him into their tribe, and he goes swinging, making a Tarzan noise through the jungle with the monkeys.
Yeah.
I forgot that happened until you just said that.
And we're all sorry for it.
Yes, it's a terrible movie, and they just lost the sense of what they wanted to do.
Literally, the movie ended, and the only thing that I was left sitting there thinking was, man, I wish I had an old Frigidaire refrigerator in case, you know, we go through nuclear, you know, war here in... Yeah.
Well, thankfully, back when Frigidaires were still kind of the thing, you know, in the 80s and whatnot, like, glad this movie didn't come out then. We talked about pretending to swing from the vine, you know, but a lot more traumatic Frigidaire locked deaths.
I know. I'd have been in there.
But, well, no, because you would have seen this movie and been like, that's junk. And never watched it again. I mean, there were things in there, like, I kind of feel that a lot of the responsibility is on Lucas. I feel that their relationship was different coming back to make this movie.
Yeah.
I want to know, what I need to know is, where is Lucas's involvement on the fifth one? Is he out?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if he's out, I'm in.
Yeah, yeah.
But Spielberg's been talking about it. He says he promises Indiana Jones won't die at the end of Indiana Jones 5. And I think Shia LaBeouf has burned enough bridges that Mutt Williams probably was killed somewhere along the line. Indy may have choked him to death or put him in a fridge. Who knows?
He's still in the refrigerator. Yeah.
So he does. But Spielberg, I think, tries to bounce back from that. And again, a few years later, does his two movies again.
Yeah. And now, you know, what essentially we've been talking about is the Spielberg magic. You know, Spielberg, when he's on, there's just, in my opinion, there's no one better. And you just get this sense of awe and wonder. It doesn't matter whether you're young or old.
I agree.
You're enthralled with the storytelling. You're enthralled with what's going on in the cinematography. And so we come now to Tintin, The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. And Nathan, I'm going to let you go ahead and start this one off because you really enjoyed this movie.
I did. You know, it's weird because even with the kind of critic gig, I see a movie usually once and that's about it at the theater. You know, I'll watch it again when it comes on DVD or something.
Sure.
Partly because there are other people that wanted to see it, and I think they did a couple screens. I ended up seeing this movie three times, one of which I actually paid for. But the movie was – I really enjoyed it. It was a callback. First off, Tintin is based off of the comic strip.
Yes.
So I heard that originally, you know, I think we're helped inspire Indiana Jones. But then the creator of Tintin also said at one time, well, who would make a good Tintin movie? And before he passed, he said, you know, I think Spielberg could do this right. And I think he really did. He does motion capture, which is the thing that Robert Zemeckis had been playing around with Polar Express, with Beowulf, and The Christmas Carol, and all those movies came out, and then Tintin sort of follows in 2011. And the original plan, which I think has now been sort of sidelined, it's Spielberg and Peter Jackson were producing these. And before Peter Jackson showed the world what a Hobbit trilogy stretched 24 hours would look like, people still kind of had faith in him, I think. And Spielberg was supposed to direct the first one. Jackson was going to do the next one. And I can't remember what the plan was for the third one. Spielberg would come back and do the third one. We haven't gotten to the second one. That might be because, well, you know, Jackson doesn't have any time between making Hobbit movies. And I don't think it was a huge hit here. It was a bigger hit in England and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's Spielberg reconnecting with a little bit of that fun and boy's own adventure kind of style that he did well with the Indiana Jones movies. He's separate here from Lucas. And he makes the motion capture work. I kind of feel like he's able to get a little bit more freedom and imagination involved there than he did when he did some of these other movies. You can see him pushing in Indiana Jones, and now he's in the vein of animation. They got some great characters. Andy Serkis plays Captain Haddock, and he brings these characters to life. What's interesting is motion capture is always like trying to be just on this side of being real. It's like hyper-real.
Yes.
But Tintin is a very like clean line-drawn sort of animation. You know, if you look at the old cartoons, he's just suggested by a few lines. So you're like, how are you going to take something that was so evocative of just a little bit of drawing and doodling and turn it into this real thing and not lose the sense of it? But he uses the tools to make a really fun, a really giddy, kind of enjoyable movie. I really connected back to some of the stuff in my childhood watching it, but it wasn't just nostalgia, like where Super 8 was trying to press the buttons and say, remember Spielberg.
Right.
This was Spielberg sort of reconnecting himself and remembering what it was like to kind of capture that wonder, the pirate ships battling each other on the ocean, those ideas he probably had in his head as a kid reading a book. And we talk about how I think he and Lucas both have always want to shoot to just purely what was in my mind and get it out there.
Yeah.
And if they had been allowed to do that early on, I don't think they would have achieved the things they achieved.
Yeah.
But here Spielberg seems to be able to almost get as close as he can to pulling something that he envisions in his head and getting it out there on the screen. There are chase scenes that make the scene in Raiders look small by comparison. Doesn't make it better, but just he's able to make more of what he wants happen in this movie. And I really liked it. I'd be happy to watch a couple more Tintin movies if they were to make them.
Yeah.
And I think it helped him reconnect with that childlike or even family-friendly filmmaking that has a heart in a way some of these more recent movies we talked about don't.
Yeah.
Rachel?
I don't know how, but this is actually one that I missed. I hadn't seen it. I was hoping to watch it in time for the podcast, but I didn't make it, but I am planning on watching it. I don't know. This one got past me.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm the same way. I remember it came out to theaters. I remember wanting to go see it because, I mean, really just as a rule, if Spielberg's name is attached to anything prominently, I'm willing to go see it because he is when he's on, in my opinion, there's no one better, and it's well worth the time and the money to go and see his movie. But just for whatever reason, time and life got away, and so this one has been kind of left.
He released them very close together. He did this in War Horse the same
year.
And
I did go see War Horse.
And they were released almost in weeks of each other. Yeah. So War Horse was the drama. Usually he has one like in the summer and one in the winter. And they're both released in December, like within weeks of each other.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, again, we're talking about fantastical movies. You know, War Horse, I think, comes close to being a fantastical movie. The way it follows and tracks the horse. It's not one we're going to talk about, but it is definitely worth going to see.
There is a magical realist kind of sense to it, but I don't think there's anything. It does kind of fall, I think, in his other thing. It would be interesting to go back and do a second series, but we'll give some space.
That's
to
right.
Play
that's
two,
right.
Where we do another four part juggernaut because there's enough there with those movies as well.
Yeah. So now we come to his latest movie, BFG, Big Friendly Giant, and just you know, because this is going to be. More of our in-depth review. We are going to be giving more spoilers away. So for those who, you know, aren't interested in hearing those things, you can kind of cut now and go back later when you see it.
I will say our weekly review this week, which would be, I guess, episode 15 or 16.
Yeah.
Yeah, it will have a very small sort of recap that we'll talk about it from a spoiler-free perspective.
Yes.
So if you want to know, is it worth your time, go check that out. And then when you've seen the movie, come back here and listen to this.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, BFG, and we've all just recently seen this. Rachel and Nathan, you all saw it last week. Joy and I went and saw it on Monday of this week. Thoughts on it? Rachel, we'll start with you.
I was excited from the get-go, the idea when I heard he was doing this, and then even more so when I saw the preview, and I loved it. I thought it was, for me, it was a perfect melding of Roald Dahl. I read a lot of his books growing up, most of them probably. So it had all of his storytelling with Spielberg sort of bringing it to life. And so I was definitely feeling both Dahl and Spielberg, which for me, especially hearkening back to the, like, you know, the stuff that I reading and movies from my childhood, it was awesome. Like, yeah. I really enjoyed it. And the giant is just so good. Mm-hmm. The facial expressions alone make the movie.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Nathan?
I really enjoyed it too. And I think the thing that's interesting, I'm already seeing reviews, and it's funny because it seems like when movies these days, people are in a hurry with big movies to kind of pigeonhole them and tell them what they're going to be. And like, oh, it's already considered a Spielberg underperformer, even though it hasn't released yet.
Yeah.
Or it's not going to be up to his snuff. And I think the problem is that with Spielberg, we've had a long conversation about a lot of movies he's made since Jurassic Park. But there's a contingent of people out there who behave as if he hasn't made any movies since Jurassic Park or any good movies since Jurassic Park. And I think it's fine to love the Spielberg of the 80s and not get so wound up in that's all that there is to him.
Yeah.
What I loved about this movie is the same thing that Rachel just said. This is a melding of Roald Dahl and Spielberg. People have complained, well, it's not as witty, it's not as kind of acerbic as Dahl, and that's true, but it is also not as maybe as intense in proclaiming the wonder, as intense and visceral as we would expect from Spielberg. It's a lot more gentle. It's also a lot more melancholy than is typical for Spielberg. It's a PG movie, but it does indeed deal with giants eating children.
Yeah.
And in sometimes a very poignant way, and yet I will say I did take my 4-year-old son to go see it, and he loved it. This is the first Spielberg movie he's seen at the theater, and he's seen E.T., and he sat there and watched it, and he was not scared or freaked out at all during the movie. He got the idea of the bad giants. He kind of liked, oh, the bad giants that are going to eat you, you know, in a kind of shivery but not too scary sort of way.
Sure.
But he picked up on a little bit of the sadness. There is a sad undercurrent to this movie, which I don't think is necessarily true of a lot of children's films, particularly Spielberg. He always seems to wants the happy ending, but here he is content a little bit to let some of Dahl's more sad and wistful notes come through. The book that Dahl wrote, the BFG, was dedicated to his young daughter, I believe, who was 7 when she passed away. So there was already a melancholy undercurrent to the book when it started. I'll talk more about it. I really thought it was a great melding of things. And for a movie that I really liked, I will just throw this out there. It's strange that a movie I enjoyed so much that the best moment was a fart joke. But we'll get back to that.
Yes.
Nathan?
Really? I think we should hit that now. No. But yeah, I agree completely. What's interesting is Joy and I went to see this, and Joy is not typically a Roald Dahl fan. You know, James and the Giant Peach, and, you know, even, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You know, she enjoyed the one done in the 70s with Gene Wilder a little more, but they're a little trippy for her, and she doesn't tend to really get into them and enjoy them. Now, the one she did enjoy was Matilda, but that was more because of the little girl who played Matilda in the movie. She enjoyed her as an actress.
Mara Wilson.
Yes.
It probably goes without saying. Didn't Ruby Barnhill, who played Sophie in this movie, bear a striking resemblance to young Mara Wilson?
Yes. Yes,
and that's one of the things that Joy said was, you know, she thought this girl brought that real sweetness to the character that she enjoyed in Mara Wilson, in all the things that Mara Wilson did back then. And this was one of the ones that Joy did read, and she said that it actually did save a couple minor differences. It really did stay close to the book. But taking, you know, Roald Dahl's idea and putting that, as we've been saying all along, that Spielberg magic behind it really brought it to life and really made it such a fantastic movie, including the bodily humor, as Nathan mentioned. So Nathan, I love the story that you told with Jonathan, so I'm going to let you pick it up and tell it.
Yeah, so my son, who again keyed into the movie pretty early, and it was a later movie, it was at 7:30, and he was actually having some issues where he's kind of missing mom, and I wasn't sure if he was even going to come into the movie. You know, at that point we're in Annapolis, look, you're here, son, you're going in. And he sat down, and as soon as the movie started, he was like into it.
Yeah.
And he took his 3D glasses off. I don't know how he watched it without the 3D glasses, but he was just like struck by it. And you get to the drink that the giant has in Giant Country when Ruby is the giant takes her, and he goes back to Giant Country. And of course, she's very small, and everything is very large. And Frobscottle, I think, you know, sounds like it's straight out of Harry Potter. But then a lot of Roald Dahl stuff seems to be precursor to some of the silliness that Rowling brought in. So Frobscottle, the bubbles go down, not up.
What happens when the bubbles go down?
Well, the whiz poppers happen, which of course is this big, great green CGI gaseous fart, which really should be. Destroy the movie the first time it happens. Now, to be fair, this is from the book.
I was going to say, this is a pretty comical scene in the book.
There's a lot of flatulence in the book. And so, the first time he does it, it's almost like a rocket, and Jonathan is like ecstatic that, hey, this movie doesn't. It had one little scene with a train, which he loved, and it has farts too. You know, what could be better? And he he's like, Dad, you didn't tell me there were farts involved. And so he sees that, he chuckles at it, and the movie goes on. Well, we can kind of track back and talk the story, but eventually there's a pivotal bit where the little girl, where Sophie wants to introduce the Queen of England. And, you know, I didn't pick up on it but it becomes clear kind of towards the end of the movie that this does take place in the 80s.
Yes.
But it's funny because that was Spielberg's playground, and he doesn't do anything that does a lot of callbacks to the 80s, except to the point where she's calling Nancy and Ronnie on the phone.
Yes,
when the Queen, and it's Penelope Wilton from Downton Abbey. She played Matthew Crawley's mother there, and she had a lot of great back and forth with Maggie Smith in that show. And she's great here as the Queen of England, who they mix up a dream. That's a part we'll get to in a moment. And they give it to the queen, and she sees this vision of the giants eating children, or that the giants will come and get the children in the countryside. And they're already missing kids. So, I mean, there's that weird dark undercurrent. But they have a meeting with the giant. The giant comes and he sits down in Buckingham Palace. And it's the scene is just so imaginative in the way that they have built things so he can eat and he can sit in the same room with the queen. And she has her three little fat corgi dogs running around. And then he brings out the Frobscottle. Mm-hmm. And there's just gas all over the place. And the guards are blowing up against the walls. And then there's this just the one shot. Penelope Wilton, stone-faced, regal, staring forward and rips one. And the whole tablecloth blows off the table.
This is a brilliant scene. You would think that that sounds like so horrible, but it was somehow done tastily.
And then the corgis go blasting through the palace as if they're little green rockets. And Jonathan is almost in tears. He is just laughing in a way like he's so tickled by it. I've never seen him be that tickled that he's lost the sense of himself. And he's just laughing and laughing and he can't control.
He was just completely engaged with the movie. And I think that that was telling.
That was a highlight. I think Greg said on the previous podcast, you know, when you're watching a movie with your kids and they're into it, you're into it regardless.
Yes.
But I will say that was a really funny scene. Mm. Fart humor is you want to take me out of your movie, do fart humor. Because it's a lowest common denominator, and usually the joke is, ha, someone farted. And that's the end of the joke. Spielberg, I don't know if he's ever tackled something like this before, but he got the same kind of silliness that Dahl gets, where he takes propriety and he throws it out the window, but he's not throwing it out the window. What he's doing is reducing you to a childlike state where something small and something silly can amuse you.
It was completely ridiculous and crazy without being too over the top, without being too just crass and crude, I think. I mean, it's hard to say that there was a fart scene without it being, like, crude. But, I mean, I'm thinking about stuff like Alvin and the Chipmunks and stuff like that, where it's just nasty, like, stuff just happening over and over again to giggle at it. This was actually, like, I don't know, there was more to it than just...
Well, it goes back to what makes a child laugh about something in the first place. It's the first time they're surprised by their body or someone else's body. Yeah. There's a weird, innocent joy. And the joy that is in this scene, you get the perspective of the giant who is... He's engaged and he's kind of coerced out to come into the real world, to the human world, because it's intriguing to him. And he is amazed by it. And he finds things like the Frobscottle and stuff like that kind of wondrous when he sees what it's doing to all the human characters and whatnot.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of connecting back to the childlike joy there that... In even all the reviews I've read so far where not everyone's happy with it, the scene that everyone is lifting up is this scene of this like flatulence. And again, a lot of that is down to that scene of the queen. And, you know, but also we're talking about this huge scene, but it lasts seconds.
Yes.
We're not talking about a 20-minute wall-to-wall fart scene where just farts keep going and going and going.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's very well put together. It's very comedic. It harkens back to like Mel Brooks and stuff like that. I thought it was really well done. And it was just—it was a genuine, surprising laugh for me in a movie that is not really a comedy.
No,
I mean, I wouldn't say it's super dark, but it has some dark elements, which I'd kind of like to delve into a little bit. I mean, to be fair, the giant kidnaps Sophie.
Yeah,
he takes
her for his own like self-protection.
For his own self-protection, he does, and he's done it before, and it didn't turn out so good. And he's done it again. He grabs her because. He thinks she will tell on him and he will be captured. So he takes her back to Giantland. The last kid this happened to, they were friends, but the kid got eaten.
Yeah.
And there's that really strange scene where Sophie is talking to him and she says, well, was he afraid? And he says, by the end, he was. And
it's eerie scene.
Yes. And you don't – I was thankful that Spielberg doesn't flash back. We don't see the child. We don't see what happened. We have a really touching scene though, where Sophie trying to hide by the other giants who have horrible names like Child Chewer and the Butcher Boy and like Meat Lump Head and whatnot. And they – and the lead giant is Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords is the voice. So he has the big hulking kind of pretty stupid bad guy down to a T here. And it's really good. And these giants are looking for Sophie inside the BFG's home.
Yes.
And she goes in to the little nest that used to actually be the room that the little boy lived in. And you can see the sadness that Mark Rylance cast as a giant. He has such a kind and effusive face. Like the animation on the giant mixed with Rylance's features, he's just so...
Yes.
His eyes alone, like when he says things, when he does things, he's a completely believable character.
Yes, very much.
And when she goes in and sees the child's room, there are drawings that he has done of him hanging out with the BFG. And the cool thing about that, I don't know if Joy picked up on this, those drawings are done in the exact same style as the illustrations in the original book. Mm-hmm. So it's like a harking back to that those original illustrations in the original BFG. So, but I thought that that sad, melancholy element of the movie was strong and was very intriguing to me because it's what carried me through. I think it's a great movie, but I don't think it's necessarily this really intense action-adventure spectacle. There are no scenes in and of themselves that are like, wow, I can't wait to see that scene again for the spectacle and the roller coaster it is. It's not that kind of a movie. Even the scenes where the giants are chasing her, the resolution to the evil giants, which I want to talk about, is kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
This is really a two-hander between the little girl and the giant. The scenes of wonder when he's running through the landscape, going from the real world back to the giant world, and the scene where they go hunting the dreams were, I thought, really, they had a dreamlike feel. They had a feel where they were, and what I mean by dreamlike is it felt like they were propelled by emotions, not by logic. Which is to say, like, the melding of the John Williams score, the cinematography, even the special effects. We were watching these two lonely characters interact, learn about each other, and be trepidatious about believing in finding a friendship and finding a world that made sense to them where they could be more than they were.
I think within those elements, like, where for me, you had, like, the marrying of, like, Spielberg and Dahl and sentiment. It was... You had, for me, like when he goes in there catching the dreams, that's a beautiful scene. And that, to me, is Spielberg because it's beautiful scenery and it's very whimsical and it's very magical. And you're kind of swept off in this scene, which even that has the darker elements when he catches a very bad like dream. It's red and it's buzzing. But then you have that matched up with Dahl's storytelling, which sometimes is very much from a child perspective. Because when you're talking about coming up to the resolution, it seems absurd, you know, to a grown-up watching it. It's absurd that they would go and the queen, really the queen's involved and we have his army and stuff. But if you think about it from a kid's perspective, particularly a child in Britain, if they were really in this situation, who are they going to, like, look to? The queen, whose, like, face is on the stamps everywhere. Because that's what she does. She sees a picture of the queen and she was like, I know who we need to call. So in that sense, you have that childlike idea and thinking that Roald Dahl grafted into his stories, but then it's matched up with Spielberg's whimsy. And though he has that ability to take something that's more somber, that's a little bit more melancholy, and make it more a more sweeping tale. And so you've got this sweeping, moving Spielberg film, and it's lined up with it's kind of, I thought, very smoothly lined up with Roald Dahl's from like a childhood, the way that everything's done from a childhood's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, Nathan, because you talked about just how serious the movie is. And it didn't hit me until we're in that scene in the palace with the giant. And again, just laughing. And that's when, you know, I really thought like, wow, you know, this is the first time I've really been laughing and enjoying the movie from a comedic standpoint. I enjoyed the movie overall, but this is the first time that I think I started really laughing and smiling and really feeling more upbeat with the movie because it is more somber and it is more, you know, I mean, this girl's in an orphanage. You know, and that's where the BFG finds her. You know, she's kind of the level-headed one in the orphanage above the caretaker, going in and getting the mail and putting it in its proper place and making sure everyone is, you know, asleep and tucked in. And yeah, exactly. And so we see her taking more responsibility, even when the drunks are out at night. She's the one who's yelling at them, you know, to go away before she calls the police, you know, that they're going to wake someone up. And so we see that more mature element that we saw in Matilda, you know, where the little girl is the more mature person in her world that she's connected to, and then she's introduced to this giant. And being with this giant gives her hope and teaches her how to, you know, hope for things, how to dream again. You know, and eventually we do see her dreams coming true at the end of it. But really, it's within the last, you know, 15 minutes of the movie that you really feel like, oh, wow, this is, you know, this is kind of lighthearted and this is happening kind of quickly, all these things coming together. But really, for most of the movie, you know, you're kind of like, wow, even the scenes that have that sense of wonder, like you were talking about, Rachel, where they're collecting those dreams, and that is such a cool scene put together, beautifully shot. You're in awe of the scene, but you're not there like joyfully bounding around with it, you know? And you don't really get that until the end of the movie.
Yeah, the dream scene, I think, is definitely like a standout, like visually. I really love the way everything was done with we see these movies where you always have the height difference, you know, here's the giant, mm-hmm. and there's a person in a land where everything is big, you know, so with the Borrowers and with, like, the various Gulliver movies they've made over the years. And in this, I thought there was a really neat storybook style where mm-hmm. things are emotional, too, because while Sophie is small in this world, she has a very big impact, which is the opposite when she's in her own world, where she's normal size in her world, but she has almost no impact that people see or aware of. At least that's the way she feels. So when she gets to giant land and giant country, I mean, things kind of revolve around her because the BFG wants to keep her safe. The big giants want to eat her. Mm-hmm. And he is also the runt, so, you know, she finds herself trying to stick up for him. She's like, at one point when they're watching the giants come back from, I guess, what might have been a nighttime mission to raid and eat children, and then she's coming back and she says, you can't keep living like this.
Yeah.
The BFG, like, what are you doing? And she is sort of that sense and voice that brings him around. And of course, it goes both ways. But I did feel it was a genuine relationship there, a friendship that worked in different ways than E.T., a larger sense of innocence with Elliot and E.T. And with these characters, it's not that the little girl isn't innocent and whimsical in some ways, or that the giant himself doesn't have some whimsy and innocence to him. But they've both been through things. They've both seen things. They both have experienced loss and not knowing where they belong exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's an element there where this is a very different kind of friendship because it is built off of pain as much as it's built off of hope or connected happiness. Yeah. And I think that's interesting. It gives the whole movie a heart and a connectivity to it that carries it through some of the patches where I don't think it is as impacting or is like grand as we may want it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it is definitely Spielberg has some soft gloves in some of the scenes, I think, but I think he does that so it allows Dahl's gentler sensibilities to come through the movie. You know, I didn't want to see a giant scene at the end of the giants pummeling each other.
Right.
But I do want to talk about how that wraps up. They call the military essentially, you know, the kids like, well, call the queen and the queen will bring in the guard. But the catalyst is the dream that the giant finds. And he, when he gets it, he says, it was something like, you know, this is the most horrible thing from which there is no forgiveness.
Yeah.
Something really deep and dark.
Yeah.
And when he says this, I'm thinking he says it in such a personal way that he's connected to something in the dream himself. The dreams seem to be combinations of feelings and fragments of ideas, and they seem to maybe not be all the same thing to everyone. I'm not quite sure about that, but the giant, when he says this, I don't think he's revealed yet that the child has been his previous friend had been eaten.
Yeah,
but he has some guilt over bringing Sophie away from her world into a world that's dangerous, and we realize he did the same thing before, and tragedy ensued. And I thought that when he says that's he's referencing his own sin, if you will, because that's what's implied. There's sin implied that you've done this thing from which there will be no forgiveness, that the giant has done this unforgivable thing, or that there is this unforgivable thing captured in this dream. Later, I thought it was really interesting because it isn't with pyrotechnics or with great brute force or the opening of the Ark of the Covenant that defeats the giants. He uses this dream, and when he gives it to him, what it does is it can basically convicts them of their sin,
right.
Their sin of eating children.
Yes.
They become aware of the gravity the moral gravity of the thing they've been doing all this time.
Yes.
And they break down into tears. But it's weird because the scene is done very – it's still in the comedic bent. And it's kind of funny to watch the big scary giant sniveling and crawling around.
Yeah.
And I thought that I really wanted to see an element of what was in that dream. Not necessarily all of it. I don't want to see giants eating children. But there's an impact that's a little bit lost there. I wanted to see the catalyst that made the giant – and I wanted to see genuine – I didn't want that to be a scene done funny, or that's when all the big special effects are rolling about and the military comes in to get the giants. I wanted something a little smaller, I think, there. I wanted to see what the what was in that dream.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I think part of the relationship between the girl and the giant, you know, an aspect of their relationship is her boldness with his subtlety. That's yes, time and again throughout the movie. That's just interwoven in there when she's wanting to go do big bold things, and he's like, "But we got to do it, you know, this way." Another aspect of Roald Dahl's, you know, doing things from a child's perspective is the big boldness. Is you're like, are you really? Is it really the queen's involved and the army's involved? Is it really going this high? But you would think that a child, especially a child in Britain, would think. And she sees a picture, you know, of the queen, and she's like, I know, we have to involve the queen, which seems super far-fetched, but in a child's mind, especially a child from England, would think, that's where we got to go. That's where we got to go to get some. That's who can help us. That's who has the ability to help us. But then the giant, his way is to kind of use the dreams to get in people's heads and to get their, you know, that's the way he's going to turn the queen. That's the way he's going to turn the other giants. Is he's a little bit more subtle, where she's like, let's just go get the queen and we'll just take care of him. And but there is a little bit of anticlimactic bits at the end. I felt it less with the final resolution. I felt it more with the sequence that you're talking about, where they're dreaming and they're kind of experiencing remorse, but it's more of them just kind of rolling around saying, oh, no, you know, I'm so sorry. But what he mentions when he's like, the sense of you can never be forgiven, that line carries so much more gravity and depth to it than what you are experiencing with the giant, other giants later on.
Mm. Yeah. And I think to what you both have been talking about, that one scene where the military comes in, I feel like this movie does a good job of keeping a good pace to everything that's going on. But when it came to this scene, it was over very quickly.
Yeah.
All the giants were captured and wrapped up within a time of less than, I think, 5 minutes, maybe even like 3 minutes.
There's no fight. There's not even that much danger to... Yeah, I thought there would be more danger for Sophie, who has to go in there and basically throw the potion out, you know, to let the dream affect them. But once the dream hits them, and that's why I say I think we needed to see the gravity of the dream, the effect of the dream that drops them, you know, because there's no fight left. They just get grabbed. And it's okay for a kid's movie, but the movie, there's so much more to the BFG, I think, as a movie than a kid's movie.
Yes.
I think it captures some of Spielberg's great, some of his great things he thinks about. And of course, there's an element where BFG is another story that is about filmmaking, in a sense. If you think of filmmaking as, Rachel, what you just said, where there's the brash person who wants to, I want to tell you now, I want to do this, I want to get this, and we're going to do it this way. It's like, well, we're going to change a person's thoughts first.
Yeah.
We're going to work, we're going to create dreams, we're going to create dreams together out of pieces of things we've already felt and experienced, and we're going to put that out in the world, and it's going to infect people, and it's going to change them.
Yeah.
So it's Spielberg, again, kind of commenting on the very thing he's done all these years, just in his own chosen profession.
Yes.
So it kind of brings it back. And I thought he did a decent job without it being too on the nose or over the top. I thought that all of those scenes really worked. I'd love to go see it again just for Mark Rylance as giant and to see it on the big screen because, it seems like it's getting a kind of soft response from critics, but I'm very enthusiastic about it, particularly in a season when we haven't had a lot of really good stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to see where he goes next. Is there anything else you guys want to say about the BFG?
I don't think so. Other than I've said it several times on this podcast, but it's true. You know, this is when Spielberg is on, I don't think there's anyone who is greater at making a movie. And then to top it off at making a movie that can bring both children and adults together in appreciation of that movie. And I think this movie, the BFG, does that very well. It brings children into the world and invites them into the world without going over their head, but without, you know, sinking down so beneath their level that it's stupid. But it brings adults into this magical world too, that they can just fall in love with and look at the beauty. One thing that Joy kept mentioning is the art of the cinematography that was going on in there.
Did you guys see it in 3D?
We did, yes.
I actually thought it was a great use of 3D.
I agree.
Like, it helped magnify those sense of spatial proportions.
Yes.
And the giant and the little girl when she's sleeping at the top of the ship that he's laying in and asleep. Like, there were lots of scenes, and it's all pretty subtle. There's nothing big jumping out to grab you or anything like that. A lot of it is peeking through his little house and seeing into the nest where she's sitting. Like, it's a lot of spatial. That's a sign of a really of a director that has his cinematographer and everybody else and the special effects people doing exactly what he wants them to do.
Yes. And I think that does this. And so it's a movie that just adults can just enjoy and just appreciate that beautiful art that's been brought out. And you can feel free to take your children and know that you're not going to have to worry about anything, you know. I mean, you have to know your children. Some children are more sensitive than others. It does deal with giants eating children, so
no children are eaten on screen.
No children were injured in the making of this movie. And so, you know, you do have to think about those things and consider those things, but it is just a fun Spielberg magic movie that you can go to and just fall in love with.
I think, even as an adult going to watch it, this was just a fun movie. It was good storytelling. It was engaging, which is not something that I feel like we get in many movies, but especially in kids' movies, that you just go, it's fun, it's engaging, it's magical, and you kind of, you know, you go along for the ride. You get taken away with this one.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts, Nathan,
before we close out? I agree. I think what I like about this and also with Tintin is we see him really, Spielberg coming back and going through the venue of a children's movie, but I feel like reconnecting with the zest and the zeal that he had when he was first making movies. I like some of his serious movies. I think some of them are good, but I feel like that is where some of his weaknesses, some of the emotionally maudlin things he gets caught up in. Mm-hmm. When he kind of does a movie from a child's perspective, he truly embraces that. I think that's when he can come to the fore. Again, we're not talking about making a kid's movie that's insulting to people or even just a family movie, but a movie that embraces a childlike sense of wonder that has the potential to really. We have so many movies that are about belief, but lots of times I feel like Spielberg movies catch that very simple concept of, without having a target for the belief, but the idea of what is it to believe in something enough that it changes your life and it changes things around you. And I think there's elements of that here in this.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to, I think his next big fantasy movie is going to be Ready Player One, based off the Ernie Cline story, which is actually a science fiction story. It deals with virtual reality and things like that, but it has a lot of 80s references in it, including a lot of Spielberg references, which I think Spielberg has said are not going to, his particular references won't be in the movie, but it should be very interesting to see. It'll be him tackling something that will be a little bit different because it's going to name check a lot of the kinds of things he's already played with. So
perfect.
I hope you enjoyed this. We had a great time going through it, and it would be fun sometime to go back, I think, and check out some of his other stuff.
Absolutely. All right. We're out of here. See you later.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?